Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Up today, we'll hear first from the journalist Harry Brown, author of The Frontman, Bono in the Name of Power, just out from Verso. He dissects the devious uselessness of the U2 singer's alleged social activism. And then we'll hear from the longtime Japan watcher Amon Fingleton, who just doesn't buy all the standard stories about Japan's supposed long economic depression. First up, Harry Brown. Originally from the U.S., we share a past in the Upper West Side of Manhattan and New Jersey, though neither at the same time. He's been living in Ireland for the last couple of decades. I've long been revolted by the pomposity, bombast, emptiness, and hypocrisy of Bono, and now Brown has written the book on the topic. Just out in Verso's Counterblast series, The Frontman is sharp, funny, and deadly accurate. Harry Brown. Welcome, Harry Brown. What got you to write a book about Bono?
I got to writing it because I was asked to write it, strangely enough. The folks came to me, actually. They originally, the folks from Verso came to Jeff St. Clair from Counterpunch, and Jeff asked me to work with him on it, and then he actually couldn't carry through with it for personal reasons, and I was left on my own with this odious task of writing a big book about Bono. So that's the short answer. I've done it because I was asked. I've also, though, been watching Bono for a long time. I've been living in Ireland since the 1980s, and following his career, following the evolution of his politics. I've written bits and pieces about him before, mostly for Counterpunch, but also for some Irish newspapers and websites. And it seemed like a pretty good idea, not because of any great personal animosity for the guy, but because I reckoned that he stood for something that was worth trying to critique.
What's his image in Ireland?
His image in Ireland is, for the most part, pretty bad with ordinary people that you speak to. On the other hand, he's well-liked and well-looked after in the media and by political elites in Ireland. So you certainly couldn't say that, you know, if you pick up a paper in Ireland, he's being attacked. Quite the contrary. It reminds me a little bit of when I first came to Ireland in the 1980s. Attitudes to the Catholic Church among ordinary people had already started to change into a very strongly negative view. But if you picked up a newspaper, there were the bishops on the front page being uncritically reported whatever it was they were saying. And to a certain extent, I think Bono is like that. He is a pretty sacred figure in elite circles. At the same time, you know, there's graffiti all over the place against him. If an internet thread opens up in Ireland in which Bono was even mentioned, it tends to be 5-1 against him, with people discussing his tax situation for the most part, but also his arrogance, his pomposity, his self-regard, etc.
Now, of course, that fits into a history of Irish people somewhat resenting the success of other Irish people.
Right? Yeah, that's right. There's a word that we use in Ireland a lot called begrudgery, which is the kind of resentment of other people's success, as you say, and it's often described in Ireland as a peculiarly national characteristic and one that we should eliminate because it means that we knock our entrepreneurs and our rock stars and whatever, and Bono has been both an entrepreneur and a rock star, of course, in Ireland. Insofar as it's a real characteristic of Irish life, and I think probably it is to some extent, I think it's probably born out of a kind of an understanding that success does come at a price, that, you know, that morally, politically, historically, people who got on in Ireland got on because they kissed up to the landlord or they kissed up to the church or whatever. And so I think that, you know, it's a healthy enough attitude, as far as I'm concerned, although I get roasted for defending it in Ireland, but I think begrudgery is actually, you know, a healthy suspicion of success in an unfair world. Success is probably going to have been arrived at.
But it's also it shows traces of a colonial history too.
I think it absolutely is. It's you know, I don't want to get dragged into too much post-colonial talk, but I think absolutely it is partly colonial. But in the Irish media, for the most part, begrudgery is mentioned in order to be denounced. you know, that we've got to get over it. To a certain extent, the Celtic Tiger was seen in many Irish parts of Irish discourse as our at last our chance to eliminate begrudgery, because we were all rising on the same tide. Of course,
didn't quite work out.
So the end of the Celtic Tiger, to a certain extent, has meant a bit of a comeback for begrudgery, because an awful lot of the people who are seen domestically as having been responsible for the Celtic Tiger were exactly the people that we were told not to begrudge their success. Bono is one of them, but he's only one of quite a large cast of characters.
And before we delve into the man himself, one more question. Did you have any pre-existing feelings about U2's music?
I was kind of betwixt and between about U2's music. I certainly would never have wanted to sit down and listen to an entire album. I've never been to one of their gigs, although I did once sit across a river and listened to about a half an hour of a show they were doing in a stadium in Cork back in probably in the late 80s, early 90s. And a perfectly pleasant experience in the sense of the kind of that stadium excitement that they could generate. I don't hate stadium rock. I'm a Bruce Springsteen fan. And there's some songs of theirs that I think are genuinely pretty nice songs. I don't think there's been all that many of them, and I think it's been a long time since they've made one. But I wouldn't be a hater.
I did a piece for The Nation, I don't know, about 7-8 years ago, after seeing Bono and Jeffrey Sachs do a performance together at NYU, and I described U2's music as bombastic and unlistenable, and I've never gotten so much hate mail for something I've ever written in my career.
I think that describes quite a lot of their music reasonably well, but I wouldn't want to see all of their songs sort of eliminated from the world. And I'm sorry I didn't read your piece in The Nation about Bono and Jeffrey Sachs. I'd say that would have been grist for my mail.
It was quite a tour they were doing together. I think it was when they were first falling in love. It was remarkable to watch. Okay, so Bono, what's his background? He likes to present himself as something of a scrappy son of the inner city?
Yeah, one of, you know, four Irish boys from the north side of Dublin. And in fact, he is from a not quite as posh background as two of his bandmates, Adam Clayton and The Edge, were really quite well off. Larry Mullen from a more almost working class background in Dublin. Bono himself, his father was a sort of clerical worker in the postal service. So working in the public sector in a well enough paid job, a good job, as people would have seen it at the time. And Bono himself grew up in what you would recognize certainly in Dublin terms as comfortable suburbia, although in an area that was adjacent to a poorer area and to working class public housing. And so that Bono can talk about the north side, he can talk about Ballymun, the famous and infamous towers of North Dublin in Ballymun would have been visible from his bedroom window. And he would have traded over the years on this notion that he came from in or around there. And to a certain extent, one of the things that he's criticized most for in Ireland is for doing that, because Irish people are kind of protective about certain kinds of geographic and class definitions. And north-sidedness in Dublin is indicative of a kind of a real Dublin salt of the earth working class character that people think rightly Bono doesn't quite belong to. There's also the additional wrinkle of the mixed marriage that he was born from. So his mother was from a Protestant background, his father from a Catholic background.
It's interesting. And he went to one public appearance, he reversed the order. Like, it's just,
that's right. Yeah, it's strange. He made a speech in which he referred to his mother being Catholic and his father being Protestant, which is a funny sort of a slip. But in any case, he does come from that background, which would have set him apart a little bit anyway, and meant that he went to schools with largely sort of better off Protestant children. And to the high school that he went to, the secondary school that he went to in particular, was a posh liberal school in an area of the north side called Clontarf, a beautiful seaside area in Dublin, which would have been extremely liberal by the standards of Ireland in the 1970s. So this kind of sense of the kind of dark, benighted Ireland of the past that he often evokes and that people often evoke on his behalf is a half-truth. I mean, certainly I wouldn't want to play down the awful nature of Irish repressive legislation, of the sexism of Irish public life at that time. You know, married women couldn't keep a job in the public service or in the banks up until the mid-1970s. You know, to a huge extent, membership of the European Economic Community, as it was at the time, did bring about changes. While Bono was a teenager, Ireland was essentially being transformed bit by bit in many respects, being sort of lifted out from under the yoke of the church. But he certainly would have been in a social space that was relatively free of that kind of heavy hand.
How did he find his way into music?
Well, he joined the band with these guys. There was sort of advertised on the bulletin board in his school, and they got together and they mostly played covers of Peter Frampton, the Eagles. This is in 1976, even into 1977, when the rest of us were catching on.
Punk was being born.
Yeah, and I think it's been said anyway that the Clash coming to Dublin sort of changed the scene in Ireland, and their name originally was Feedback, and then it was the Hype, and then with the kind of more militant punk ethos coming in, which they eventually by 1978 were sort of catching on to, they changed their name to U2 at that point.
And then Rolling Stone declared U2 one of the great bands of the 80s.
Yeah, that was well into the 80s that they declared that. 1985 or so, I think Rolling Stone said U2 was the band of the decade. And at that point, they were pretty big in America. They hadn't moved up from arenas to stadiums, though. In fact, I think they had barely moved into arenas even by the time Rolling Stone said that. And certainly they weren't having number one singles or anything like that, and their albums were charting respectably, but not hugely successfully. But they were critical favorites in America from quite early on in a way that they weren't, for instance, even in Britain. And I think partly maybe that had to do with Bono's character himself. He was, and I think to a certain extent is, charming, motor mouth.
If you like that sort of thing.
Yeah, if you like that sort of thing. He talked a great gig, you know, and this was written about him even at the time, you know, that it wasn't so much their music or their shows, it was the interview you'd get with Bono afterwards that convinced you that you were looking at something special. And I think that...
Yeah, you describe it almost Clinton-esque talent of making it, you seem like you're the only person in the world, you're crucial to everything.
That's right, and he had a particular way of working that talent on people who really mattered. And, you know, the top music writer in Ireland, the top DJ in Ireland, were convinced by talking to him as much or more than by actually listening to the music of U2. Now, I think the early music of U2 is pretty bad. The quite early stuff, the stuff that would have been the basis of their original contracts, is really not interesting stuff. I think they do get more interesting. His songwriting gets a bit better. The Edge gets his echo unit, and they sort of develop that distinct guitar-led sound that is the kind of signature of U2 song after U2 song. The band of the decade thing happens right at around the time that they go from being one of many sort of popular trendy bands to being really an international phenomenon. And that's the period of Live Aid. It's the period that leads up to the Joshua Tree album in 1987. That's really the period in which he becomes something more than just that singer with the funny haircut from that Irish band.
I'm speaking with Harry Brown, author of The Front Man, Bono in the Name of Power, just out from Verso. Live Aid, that is kind of what launched him as...
As a singular character,
the savior of Africa, I know.
That's right, and the funny thing is the performance that U2 gave at Live Aid, you know, 18 minutes or so like everybody else got, Bono doesn't mention Africa from the stage at all. He's not involved really in organizing Live Aid. He'd just been one of the singers on the Band-Aid single. U2's performance is legendary because Bono jumps off the stage, goes down to the edge of the audience, pulls a girl out of the crowd and starts dancing with her, and it's suddenly We Are the World. And Bono becomes a figure in his own right at that point. But he went to Africa afterwards, but he had not really been part of the rhetoric about saving Africa that his fellow Irishman, Bob Geldof, had been very much the lead in that respect. But it's after Live Aid that Bono begins to show an interest in this. Although to some extent, Bono himself talks about 25 years of anti-poverty activism or whatever. It's an exaggeration because in the mid-80s, he does go to Africa, he does a few gigs and benefits, and he's involved with Amnesty International for a brief time. But actually, for most of the late 80s and 90s, he doesn't have much to do with Africa at all. He doesn't even visit Africa again between 1985 and 1998. And then he gets involved in the Drop the Debt campaign leading up to the millennium after that. So there really are two phases of his activism. I think one of the things that you can argue, the stuff that he was doing in the 80s, not so much Live Aid, but for instance, working with the Sanctuary Movement here in the United States, which was working with refugees from Salvador, doing stuff that was in solidarity with the Sandinistas in Nicaragua. That was good anti-poverty work. I'd say in a way, and we can see in Latin America today where genuine anti-poverty achievements are being done by left-wing governments who are very much in the tradition of the FMLN and the Sandinistas, you could argue, that if you want to eradicate poverty, supporting left-wing movements in the developing world is probably the best way to go about it, not what he did from 1998 onwards, which was essentially to kiss the asses of the powerful in the West.
Yeah, I was at the World Economic Forum in 2002, and they had it in New York just after September 11th, and there was a joint press conference with Bill Gates and Bono. Like, what am I doing here? Yeah. When did he start really frequenting those circles?
Well, really, it starts in about 1999. He gets involved at the end of 1998 with the Drop the Debt campaign. And he has quite a good start in that campaign because the British government, Gordon Brown in particular, who was the Chancellor of the Exchequer at the time, wanted to position Britain as being at the forefront of efforts to eradicate third world poverty. I thought that was a nice spin. And Bono does a few public things, op-ed in The Guardian, an appearance at the Brit Awards where he talks about the injustice of African debt. And he's not wrong. It was a gross injustice, and he is a gross injustice. But he quickly, in 1999, decides to focus his attention on the United States. And he is in contact with the Kennedy family, and he hooks up with Bobby Shriver. And it's really from 1999 when he starts essentially being a kind of a Washington lobbyist in many respects, with very, very good connections. Bobby Shriver was not only a member of the Kennedy family, but he'd been just working previously for a Wall Street firm that Jim Wolfensohn, who was the head of the World Bank, had been the CEO of. So Shriver was extremely well connected. Bono, very quickly, having just joined this campaign at the end of 1998, finds himself at the focus of a very powerful set of elites in Washington, you know, kind of Rockefellers, you know, the Clinton administration itself, the Kennedy family. And by the time Clinton leaves office in 2000-2001, Bono is really very well set up in there and has every reason to continue to work with the next administration.
Well, why do these people take this guy seriously? Why didn't they just say, oh, this is some stupid pop star, what do I care what he has to say?
That's a good question, and I think they realized that he was potentially useful. The things he was asking for weren't big asks. You know, the cost to the United States of, I mean, before Bono even came on the scene, there had been proposals to reduce the debt obligation of African countries, of some of the poorest African countries to the United States. And he was only looking for a little more of that. The cost would have been measured in the hundreds of millions at most in debt that probably was never going to be paid anyway. So it was an opportunity to kind of associate themselves with
the development establishment. Obviously, good kind of stuff. World Bank and such.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, this was pretty, it was reasonably mainstream. It was an argument within the mainstream. There were certainly people who said, no, we can't do this because in principle, you know, it sets a bad example. But not because it was actually going to be any real threat to
to
any major elite interests. That's exactly right. And people who were in Washington at the time talk about how it was the staffers on Capitol Hill and in the White House, the people, the kind of the under 40s, I guess, who maybe had grown up with U2's music in their elite colleges in the 1980s, who really encouraged him and encouraged their bosses, their congressmen and their senators and their, you know, secretaries of the Treasury, et cetera, to let him in. And very quickly on the walls of congressional offices all over Washington, pictures with Bono became a very, very popular commodity. And so he decided as well that he was going to learn his trade, and he started sitting in on classes with Jeffrey Sachs at Harvard. And by 2000-2001, he's setting up a sort of a pretty permanent lobbying structure in Washington with Gates money. And then that's the relationship with Gates basically kicks off during the early years of the Bush administration, when he's setting up the organization at the time was called DATA, Debt, AIDS, Trade, Africa. And also, though, reflecting this kind of positivist attitude towards, if we gather enough information, we'll find a way to cure all the ills of the developing world.
Yeah, I do recall reading an interview with somebody, I can't remember who it was, who said, but when he talks to Bono, Bono knows his numbers.
Yeah, and that's knowing the numbers has been a big part of his shtick. Although, I mean, I think, and I've written about this outside the book in a piece I wrote for Counterpunch a couple of months ago, he knows his numbers and he knows how to twist his numbers. I mean, he did a, since I finished the book, he did a TED talk out in California, which was heavily covered, tweeted by Bill and Melinda Gates, etc. And it was an absolute tissue of, I think, half-truths is probably the best way of describing his use of statistics there, and maybe the least defamatory way of doing so as well. But he is he's extraordinary. And this idea about that numbers are the key to the solution to problems of debt and global injustice I don't want to rain on your profession as an economist, Doug. I know
I'm just a journalist.
Numbers are important. Numbers are very important. But his kind of reification of the idea that that if we have the numbers, we solve the problems.
We take politics out of it.
Take politics out of it, exactly. And I think if the book that I've written has one key message, it's that the notion that you can take politics out of the question of global justice and poverty is a nonsense. And when Bono attempts to run the numbers to do that, his numbers are so shabby that in a way he illustrates that point. And, you know, this TED talk effectively, and this has been part of his rhetoric over the last year or so, really since I finished the book, has been, you know, we've won. We're halfway to the complete eradication of poverty. You know, he was on Charlie Rose there recently saying, "Hey, congratulations, America! You've basically eliminated AIDS in Africa. You know, the all the money that you've given has saved so many lives. In fact, 650,000 people have died so far this year from AIDS, mostly in sub-Saharan Africa. There are 2.5 million new infections in the last year from HIV. And the numbers in sub-Saharan Africa in particular, where Bono does his work, are rising." You know, and the whole point of the Gates activism and the Project Red that Bono has been involved in terms of getting antiretroviral drugs to people in Africa with AIDS is an enormously important fact, a need. But in West Africa, last year, fewer than 20% of pregnant women with HIV were getting the appropriate retroviral drugs to prevent transmission to their babies. So the notion that that the numbers tell us that we're getting somewhere, and that our kind of activism, and he says our kind of activism means some aid, sure, but it means, you know, foreign investment, it means recently, it means the encouragement of chemical and foreign-owned agriculture in Africa, that our solutions are working, his solutions, the Bill Gates solutions, they're not working.
Speaking of numbers, the numbers show that Big Pharma makes a lot of money on AIDS drugs.
It does.
He's never challenged the intellectual
property rights. He's never challenged that. And even at a time when Nelson Mandela, you know, not necessarily the most radical figure in development circles, was pushing for use of generic drugs in Africa against AIDS, 10 or 15 years ago, Bono's organization was not, and was clearly prepared to work with Big Pharma. Now, I think it's fair to say, and we should be fair to these people in as much as we can, that the generic drugs have been increasingly used by the Global Fund in Africa. There's been a gradual weaning away of the Western pharmaceutical companies in favor of generics, mostly from India, and I think everyone's happy. Everyone's happy that that's the case. But it certainly didn't come because of pressure from the likes of Bono. I mean, it didn't come because of an insistence from him. Let's say. I mean, I think he would have, of course, like anyone else in development circles, would have said this would have been desirable in the long run. But it was needed urgently, and it wasn't done. And he was part of a set of forces within the AIDS and development community that helped to ensure that it wasn't done.
I'm speaking with Harry Brown, author of The Front Man, just out from Verso. And we're running low on time, and there's so many things I want to cover here. So let me turn to one thing. He was pushing, of course, for first world governments to put, there was a target of 0.7% of GDP mm-hmm. for development aid. Yeah. He was pushing that. He doesn't like to pay taxes, though, does he?
That's right. It's hard to get to 0.7% of GDP if rich people are moving their money offshore and avoiding taxes. And you two have been tax avoiders for a long time. There's been publicity over the last few years because of them moving one part of their music publishing business to Amsterdam. That happened because Ireland changed its exemption on money for artists. Effectively, it put a cap on the earnings that you can claim under that exemption. So suddenly U2 realized that they needed to move their royalties business to Amsterdam. But U2 have actually been using tax avoidance structures for many, many years. It's been a very important part of their work as a business. And financial journalists...
Apple was in the news for this just recently, Google in the news. It's
yeah,
the same structure.
Absolutely the same structures and the same countries involved, Ireland and Holland, as the ways that you do it. The famous double Irish with the Dutch sandwich. And U2 have been doing it, have been doing a version of tax avoidance that uses both Ireland and Holland and other locations for a long time. So intercompany loans, offshore companies, lots and lots of companies that seem to lose money for some reason. And really, very hard to pin down. Very, you know, for, you know, Bono talks about data and transparency. His own, the business of U2, and even the business of some of his, if you like, charitable faces, like the Product Red campaign, are not particularly transparent. This idea that you can, on the one hand, say governments need to stump up, you know, and he's denounced politicians for not getting to the 0.7%. He's got crowds at concerts to boo politicians for not reaching 0.7% of GDP. And then he's making sure that there's less of that GDP in the coffers of the state by putting his money offshore.
And now, has he been visible during the Irish economic crisis?
He's been pretty quiet. He's been pretty quiet.
Because he was a cheerleader for the boom.
He was absolutely a cheerleader for the boom. And in 2009, when U2's last album came out, some tax justice campaigners decided to kind of use the opportunity to draw attention to tax avoidance as a real problem for global justice issues, you know, that because not just it's not just a question for the Irish government being able to pay its 0.7% of GDP. I mean, African governments, this report from Kofi Annan a couple of weeks ago just said that African governments are losing $34 billion a year from tax avoidance. So tax avoidance globally is a huge problem. So when these campaigners called this out to Bono, he basically said, hey, Irish people can't complain about tax avoidance. This is how Ireland got rich. This is, you know, the Irish Financial Services Center was the, and its capacity to help multinational companies to avoid taxes is exactly why Ireland has become rich. Now, he said this in 2009 when the crap had already begun to hit the fan. So his sense of timing was not terribly good there, because we now know that the hedge funds and other sort of virtual banks that sit in the Irish Financial Services Center were helping not only to bring down the Irish economy, but helping to bring down the entire global financial system. But he was still shilling that in 2009 as being of net benefit to Ireland. So no one should complain about tax avoidance, because it's how we make our money.
And finally, I'm sure there are people out there listening to this saying, okay, yeah, but he does good. Does he?
I think he probably does, Doug, but, you know, how do you measure that? I mean, effectively, he fronts for a system that doesn't do good and that is making things worse, that inequality is on the increase for the in the countries where 80% of the world's population.
And he gives cover to warmongers, too.
And he gives covers to warmongers, to Blair, most dramatically in many ways, to Bush, certainly walks in the Rose Garden, flashing a peace sign to the cameras while Bush was preparing the war in Iraq in the 2003 State of the Union address. Bush had a paragraph about AIDS, and then the next paragraph was about Iraq, and he was essentially tying the two together as sort of humanitarian concerns. And Bono has been part of that. So does he make it worse? Does he help us to believe that there's no alternative to working with warmongers, imperialists, and neoliberals? I think that he does. And so the small good that he does within those structures, I think has to be weighed against that harm.
That was Harry Brown, author of The Frontman, Bono in the Name of Power, just out from Verso as part of its Counterblast series. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break. Is yours. How some of Blow Your Tuneless Trumpet by the Mekons. The lines, we don't want the glamour and the pomp and the drums, the Dublin Messiah scattering crumbs, are about our friend Bono. Next up is Amon Fingleton. Fingleton has been covering Japan as an economic journalist for 3 decades. By coincidence, like Harry Brown, he lives in Dublin too, though unlike Brown, he's originally from Ireland. He recently had throat surgery, so his voice is a little rough. Amon Fingleton. The standard story, of course, is that Japan has been in an economic crisis for the last 20 years, unrelenting, and a grim portent for America's future if we don't do the right thing. You are skeptical of this story. Tell us why.
If you look at the reality on the ground in Japan, and I lived there for 27 years, you find that living standards in Japan have increased at least as much in the last 20 years as they have in, for instance, the United States or the United Kingdom. Anywhere in Europe. That's one thing. If you look at Japan's performance on trade, Japan has done enormously better than the United States and indeed the UK, France, and Italy. Japan has increased its surplus as measured by the current account, which is the widest and most meaningful measure of its trade in that period, whereas the UK, Italy, France, and of course the United States have increased their trade deficits.
Let's talk some about living standards. Supposedly for an economy that's been in crisis for 20 years, how has this affected the day-to-day life of ordinary Japanese, if at all?
Hardly at all. Of course, there are some negatives in Japan. It is true that the Japanese population is aging. It's also true that, of course, there was a terrible crash in the early 1990s, and that brought down real estate prices in central Tokyo by about 75%, and stock prices fell by an equivalent amount. So the picture is not entirely rosy, but as far as ordinary people are concerned, the stock market crash and the real estate crash had very little impact on their lives.
I interviewed someone last week who argued that the bubble period of the 80s covered up a lot of underlying rot in the Japanese economy, that particularly the domestically oriented sector, by being shielded from competition, by being overly cosseted, had just lost its innovative edge. The export companies are fine, but domestic Japanese companies are suffering from a lack of competition, a lack of entry, general torpor. What do you say to that?
I would like him to specify particular industries. I think that if you look at, for instance, mobile phones, cell phones in Japan, they've innovated as much in cell phones in Japan as they have anywhere else. The infrastructure, for instance, fiber optical networks and so on, the infrastructure for making sure that you don't drop your calls, it's much better in Japan than it is in the United States. That's one example where I think he would be proved wrong. But I'm not aware of any domestic sector where you would say that Japan has fallen back.
There's also this image that there's just too much overstaffing, that firms retain a lot of useless labor as sort of a social policy against poverty. Do you agree with that?
System in Japan is very different. It's rather like the German employment system in that it is deliberately intended to cushion people during downturns. In every economy you have ups and downs. In the downs in America, people are laid off. In Japan, they are generally not laid off. But there is an adjustment for this. There are countervailing forces at work. Basically, the Japanese are not paid as much as they could be paid in a hire and fire system, but they get better job security.
About that, the household income share of the economy is rather low compared to Western economies, isn't it?
It depends how you measure it. People often use non-market exchange rates for the comparison, and they're are real problems in making the comparison in terms of people spending money in different ways. The Japanese, for instance, probably spend a lot more on eating out than Americans, and they expect higher standards, frankly, both in service and in the quality of food when they eat out. The Japanese, in general, don't use their cars as much. So there are many, many differences in how people behave, and that greatly complicates any attempt to compare living standards directly. What you can do is measure living standards now versus what they were 20 years ago. And there, I think there's no question that the Japanese have done quite well.
And for a country supposedly in economic crisis, the social indicators, health and such, look pretty good, don't they?
Yeah, absolutely. The Japanese live, 4 to 5 years longer than Americans. And they've increased their life expectancy by about 4 years in the last two decades. They are, in fact, the most long-lived people among any major country in the world. And this reflects not diet, but healthcare. In terms of diet, the Japanese have gone the other way because they're eating more McDonald's and all sorts of foods that are considered bad for you, Western foods, basically, whereas their traditional diet is much more healthy. But despite the fact that they have been eating a more Western diet, they have increased their life expectancy.
And another rap against Japanese companies is that they just don't have the innovative power that American companies. There's no Google, there's no Apple. Some of the international competitors are good innovators, but companies that produce for domestic consumption are not so innovative. Is that true?
It depends what you're measuring. If you're measuring great new ideas that are very obvious to the consumer, then America is much more innovative than Japan. That's true. However, the Japanese are concerned with improving their production processes. They are very much focused on manufacturing. They think manufacturing is the key to prosperity and exports long term. And the focus, therefore, is on improving production processes in manufacturing, which they have been doing for decades, and they can have continued to do in the last two decades. So, and that is a form of innovation as well. And it's a very important form of innovation. If you think about, for instance, semiconductors, our semiconductors these days are, I don't know, 1,000 times more powerful than equivalent semiconductors 20 years ago. Somebody had to develop the production processes to achieve this improvement. And if you trace the thing back, all roads lead to Japan. The key technologies, the underlying technologies that the Koreans are using, the Chinese are using, the Taiwanese are using, are coming from Japan.
And what you're saying is they haven't abandoned manufacturing in the race to become post-industrial.
Absolutely not. I mean, they have a very clear policy at every level to stay in manufacturing. And people in the West have forgotten that what really matters is so-called producer's goods. The advanced materials, the key components, the very sophisticated precision machinery that we need to make the world's consumer goods. And it's producer's goods that the Japanese are particularly focused on these days.
And how they cope with the rise of low-wage competitors in manufacturing in their neighborhood?
They've certainly ceded ground in rather visible areas such as the production of semiconductors, such as the production of cars, to some extent. They've ceded ground in all sorts of final production of electronic goods. But to be balanced with that is the fact that they have gone more and more into the higher levels of manufacturing in producers' goods, where their presence is virtually invisible to the consumer, but is absolutely crucial to the world economy.
And you mentioned earlier that the population is aging, which would represent a problem for labor force growth. They're not really experiencing immigration. So what are they going to do about this over the longer term?
Population is aging in a transitional sense. There's a whole history to this which people have not understood. In the 1930s, in the fascist era in Japan, the Japanese leaders, in common with leaders in Germany and in Italy, had a policy of very large families to populate the empire and to create soldiers for the armies that they were building up. That policy in Japan went into total reverse in 1948-1949 when the Japanese leaders, the post-war leaders, decided, well, we're not going to have an empire anymore. There's no chance that we can aspire to an empire now. We have a problem in that we have a shortage of arable land, and basically we have a food security problem. Therefore, we will reduce our population gradually over the years. So you've had this switchback effect that has created a temporary bulge in the number of aging people. But that bulge will eventually be eliminated. Long term, if we were talking 50 years from now, I think Japan will have a much better balance in its population.
Now let's talk some about the new prime minister, Abe, and Abenomics. What do you make of this? Is this going to transform the Japanese economic life?
Well, in my view, it's a solution in search of a problem. Basically, deflation has not been a problem for Japan. There certainly has been deflation, but deflation is not necessarily a bad thing. People forget that in the United States, for instance, the best decades in American economic history were the 1880s and 1890s. And in those years, you had enormous deflation in the United States. The price of steel, for instance, fell by 80% in those two decades, those 20 years. And that is rather similar to the fall in the price of, for instance, semiconductors and other electronic items in the last 20 years. So that fall in prices has meant increasing productivity and has meant that the deflation is basically a good thing. So Abenomics doesn't really make any sense in terms of how it's presented in the West. It's frankly very difficult to know what's really going on in Japan at any one time, and I think it's particularly difficult to determine what's going on right now. But I'm skeptical about Abenomics, put it like that.
What are the likely effects going to be of loose money and unspecified fiscal stimulus?
If they're really serious about this, there would be probably inflation as opposed to deflation. If they really push the money supply, as they are talking about, then certainly there will be inflation. But I'm skeptical that they will go very far along this line. The Japanese leaders have a history of saying things and then reversing themselves. And really, public statements in Tokyo have to be read several different ways.
Now, of course, the worry warts will point to high Japanese debt levels. Do you think that's a problem?
No. I think that if there were a real problem, interest rates in Japan would be vastly higher than they actually are. Recently, the Japanese government borrows at rates that are lower than the Bank of Switzerland, which is to say the lowest rates for long-term debt in the world. If big investors were seriously worried about some sort of financial crisis resulting from Japan's debt, they wouldn't buy Japanese instruments on such low yields.
Now, Japanese interest rates have been creeping up lately. That's not a sign of some incipient turn?
Well, to the extent that interest rates have gone up a little bit, it reflects a sense that there will be at least a diminution in deflation and possibly some slight inflation going forward. So investors sense that this Abenomics will have some minimal effect in turning the deflation around.
And we touched on this a little earlier, but I want to develop it some. A lot of American critics of Japan always like to make unfavorable comparisons with the United States. They're not innovative. The individual has no room to be independent and creative. They need basically to be more like us. It seems that 4 or 5 years of economic crisis have not dented American narcissism. But what do you think of this analysis?
I think that from the point of view of the individual, America is a better society to live in, particularly if you're born into a reasonably affluent family in the United States, if you get to go to college, if you live in a good neighborhood, etc. American freedom is something to be savored, and you don't have that in Japan. In Japan, basically, you're locked into one company for life, unless you blot your copybook, in which case you're sort of out of a job and your circumstances really decline. You go from being a mid-level executive in a company to driving a taxi or something. But if your career goes as planned, you will start with Mitsubishi and you'll always be a Mitsubishi man. That can be claustrophobic, and a lot of people probably in the United States would not want to live a life like that.
But then when we get to the economic realm, the innovation, does Japanese society, you've spoken to this before, but I just want to develop it. You know, the line is that American society fosters innovation and Japanese society stifles it. Is there much to that?
Well, I think that this story about innovation should be seen in a larger context. Some of the most inventive societies of history have been highly authoritarian. If you go back to ancient history, ancient Egypt, Mesopotamia were not exactly free societies. The idea that there's a correlation between freedom and inventiveness is greatly exaggerated, to say the least. If the Japanese or the Chinese want to be inventive in an American sense, I believe they can be. It's just that hitherto it has made much more sense for them to invest in improving production processes and just copy ideas from the West. So if Apple Computer comes up with a wonderful new device called an iPhone, that's great, and the East Asians will copy it. And you see that very clearly in the case of Samsung with its Galaxy. Basically, the Japanese and the Chinese and the Koreans see the West as a source of ideas that they can copy, whereas their improved production processes are very difficult for outsiders to copy. So their hold on their innovations is much tighter than America's hold on its innovations.
And of course, Apple depends upon Chinese manufacturers to make their ideas reality.
Right, and of course, goes further than that, because the key components come from Japan. Most of the other components come from Korea or Taiwan. The Chinese are really just clicking things together and putting components in a plastic container, basically.
But there are some Americans who think that China could never really match the United States in terms of high-tech innovation, that they'll forever be sort of low to middle level detail people, but not mounting the higher grounds. Is there anything to that?
The Chinese have had an inventive past, and they were not a free society in their Middle Ages, when they were particularly inventive relative to the West. I think that going forward, if the Chinese are as successful as I believe they will be, in the next 20 to 30 years, they will start doing inventiveness on an American scale. They will probably approach inventiveness quite differently. The key thing that matters is not freedom. It's not a political thing. It's money. If you've got money, you can be inventive. And the Chinese, at a certain point, will have more money than the United States. if you look at the history of American inventiveness, it really only blossomed in the mid-20th century with World War II. And thereafter, three companies with vast amounts of money accounted for a totally disproportionate share of all America's progress. Those companies were IBM, Xerox, and AT&T. And the common thread there is money. They threw vast amounts of money into their laboratories, and lo and behold, they got great ideas coming out. The Chinese, too, can do that. So, and when they have money, which I expect will be within the next 15, 20 years, they will invest it in the same sort of way. Frankly, Bell Labs was a rather bureaucratic operation. So it's not that difficult for the Chinese to replicate the sort of inventive bureaucracy that you saw at Bell Labs, AT&T's subsidiary, or at the research and development operation at IBM.
As a journalist, Amon Fingleton has been covering Japan for like 30 years. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of the Eighth Etude for Piano by Claude Debussy, performed by Mitsuko Uchida. Till next week, bye.